As police chief, did your department ever come into conflict with Mountain County Sheriff Langley's?
Once or twice. Our vice squad boy. Chased a taxi cab out into the county. The vice squad boys were after the two women he had in the cab. And they pulled into a roadhouse where our men picked him up. I guess the roadhouse was operated by some friend of Langley's. And I presume, without knowing, that it was either a bootleg joint or a house of prostitution or a drug center. And he made a little howl about it, but not much. He and I got along fairly well. But in those days, the big police problem, which was evident to me and I think to any thinking policeman, I hadn't heard much comment about it, but I became aware of it, of course, if there's a new racket, it'll start in Youngstown. Animal chasing started in Youngstown. In the Depression, with a doctor here and two lawyers, and a couple of insurance men. The doctor would get a patient, break his leg, and x-ray it, and the lawyer would prepare an accident report where this citizen was backing his car out of his garage and ran over this woman and broke her leg. He didn't, but he had insurance. So the insurance man would collaborate with the lawyer and the lawyer with the doctor, and they would get $1,000, $2,000, split it. And if a lawyer or a doctor in those days got a couple of $100 cash, that was far better than $1,000 today. Well, they were caught, and the doctor went to the penitentiary, and two lawyers went to the penitentiary. And the doctor was released after about 5 years and came back. He was never allowed to practice medicine in the hospitals here, but he practiced medicine. Later, the one lawyer became the state prosecutor for Youngstown. But drugs. When I went in the chief's office in 53, I could see enough of the drug problem raising its head here and there. And I had known a little bit about drugs in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia and Allegheny County and other places that worked. Marijuana was the big thing in those days. But every police department for the last 100 years knows of doctors who are addicted to drugs. This town, every town, has a certain number of doctors that are addicted to drugs. But they weren't police problems. Started to scare me, and in 53, if we had a homicide, we wanted to run a ballistic test, we'd have to send the bullet and the weapon to either the FBI in Washington, or they had a second rate Bureau of Criminal Identification in the state of Ohio. We'd send him to Columbus. He'd wait 6 weeks to get an answer. He got a bit of paint scraping from a piece of metal, a hair from a human head. Anything that needed analysis, he had to send away for it. So I said, Dr. Blanky and I were close friends, and he was the coroner for 35 years. And I said to Doc one day, I would like to start a crime lab downtown. And Doc and Paul Langley were close friends, and he said, we'll do it in conjunction with Langley. Well, I didn't figure that Langley would care to go for that because he was a politician and I wasn't. I was chief of police. He would want to run it and I would serve it. So I discussed with Langley. He said, no, that's too much money. And he said, I don't think it's worth it. While I'm trying to make up my mind how to get the money, council wouldn't give me any money. We had a homicide up at the Briar Hill shooting group. A foreman went out to the parking lot. And he came back in an hour or two, and some of the men went looking for him, found him out with his head bashed in, and he was just a hell of a looking mess, deader than a donut. And the next day, 2 days later, two of our detectives were driving down Federal Street, and they saw a black man walking down the street with some scratches on his face and plasters on him and his hands, some bandages. They stopped him, talked to him a few minutes, put him in the car, took him down the station. Half hour later, he confessed that he's the guy who killed him. He said he didn't intend to kill him. He said he worked up there and he wanted some tires and some batteries, so he was stripping some of the cars in the lot. This guy caught him. And he said, I hit him once and then ran. He said, when I hit him, his head must have fallen against the bumper or something. Well, it was a damn lie because his head was beaten beyond recognition. Well, she too had called me and Mr. Motley was the chairman of the board of Cheatin' Tube, and Hugh Bennett was the chief counsel for the Cheatin' Tube. They wanted to know if they could offer a reward. That was before we brought it to. I said, geez, don't do that. What stool pigeons we have, we need, and we don't want to have to buy them every time. Give us a chance. So when we got the guy, we tried him and convicted him, and 13 weeks later, he was doing time in the penitentiary, like clockwork. Then Pete Marthy called Frank Dreisen and me up again, said, now what can we do for the police department? Frank said, ask Chief. I said, I'm glad you ask. I'm looking to buy enough equipment to start a crime lab. He said, how much do you want? And I said, I don't know. Marthy says, get out of the office and figure out what all equipment you need, what it'll cost, and bring it back. I ran from there down. We worked 2 or 3 weeks on it. I had Dr. Rappaport, he practically owned the laboratory at Northside Hospital. I had him down. I said, Doctor, tell me what kind of microscopes we need here, comparison microscopes and what else. And he said, you better get some microscopes for examining drugs. So I figured the whole thing out. Rushed back up a couple weeks later to Moffy, and I said, I'll take all or any part of this. It came to about $35,000. And Bennett looked at him and said, you think we can afford it? Moffy said, we can afford it. Go ahead and order all of it. Send us the bill. That's why I started the crime lab. But drugs were beginning to become a problem. And for those 6 years, I averaged six nights a week out of this house. Because I was trying to get across not only to the population, but to the parents, to the schools, to the churches, to the politicians, and the political groups, Republican and Democrat, clubs, that drugs are going to become the problem of the generation. And it started then. I didn't have enough men to work with, but I sent two men, Campanese and Shavi, to Washington to take a six-week course they had in narcotic drug investigation. And they came back pretty knowledgeable of drug investigation. And I kept them on it for the rest of the 6 years I was in there. And they began to search around a little bit, and the deeper they, the more it became obvious. And the result, of course, is what we have today. But drugs are still the biggest problem confronting law enforcement today. Has been the biggest for the last 10 years, and I don't see any relief in sight. There's no reason for it. There are other reasons. But if there's a cheap reason, it is that everybody wants to make money out of it. Even those who are opposed to drugs want to make money out of their opposition to the drugs. And there's a limit.
Outside of
outside of the crime lab, what were some of the other positive things that came out of your 6 years as police chief?
I gave a predominance to traffic education and traffic law enforcement. Because we were running 20 to 30 traffic deaths a year, and our insurance rates were the highest in the state, and I think the third highest in the nation. And if we could cut down on traffic accidents, we could save not only money for the people, but save a lot of lives. And I had more men assigned to traffic than anybody before that or since. Allen didn't have too many men assigned to traffic, as it wasn't traffic death was bad. But a bug pinch, that's headlines. You knew how to get the headlines. That is about all. But actually, running a police department, whether it's in a community of 1,000 people or 1 million people, it's a matter of a man becoming chief of police in a police department. He feels he has to do something different and preferably better than the guy before him. So he's got a big pile of manure here he inherited from his predecessor. So he gets a shovel and shovels it away into another pile. And he builds his own pile. The man replaces him, shovels that pile away, and creates a new pile. And that's virtually what running a police department means. That every so often you have to shovel away all the manure that's piled up for 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 years and start a new pile. crude way of putting it, but that's exactly what happened. You change the name, Vice Squad. Nobody, I called my Vice Squad a Vice Squad. The guy that followed me didn't like the word vice, so he called the Moral Squad. State legislature, they didn't like the word homicide or murder, manslaughter, or traffic death, traffic manslaughter. It made the victim or the criminal sound like a criminal, manslaughter. So they changed the state law to read homicide. And most people don't know what homicide is, whether it's an unlawful fire or a parking meter violation. But manslaughter, they know what it is. So they're trying to soft soap everything. But if you get right down to it, invariably I come back to the basic premise that BS rules the world. For example, we had a guy running for state legislature. He was a school teacher and a hairdresser on the side. And every 2 years he would get a group of religionists and come in and complain about pornographic literature, and they wanted me to close down the drug stores and everybody that handled it. And he did the same thing with Eddie Allen before me, and Eddie Allen confiscated a lot of books from Bernie, as the news company out in the South Side, I forget his name now. Anyway, Bernie sued him for $100,000, and the lawsuit was pending when he left here. I went out to see Bernie, and I said, Bernie, what are you going to do with that lawsuit? He said, are you going to close me up? I said, no. He said, I'll drop the lawsuit. He sued Allen for $100,000 and the city for $100,000. I think he could have collected too, but he dropped both lawsuits. And this guy came in, and he wanted me to close everybody up. I said, do you think they're violating the law? He said, sure. I said, can you sign your own name? He said, yeah. I said, I'll take you upstairs to the prosecutor's office and have a affidavit drawn, you sign it. He said, that's not my job. I said, whose job is it? He said, yours. I said, well, then get the hell out of here and let me do my job, will you? Anyway, it came up in council. They wanted to know what to do about it. I said, get a new law. That's one thing you can do. Can't stop it, but you get the law. I went down to my office in the state uniform criminal code, and they have a beautiful law. At that time, they had a beautiful law against pornographic literature with about, I imagine, 1,500 words. Embraced everything you can imagine about pornographic literature. Our city ordinance was about a short paragraph. So I copied this thing onto the legal stationery I got in the law department. I took it up to the law director, Phil Heike. I said, here's a new ordinance I'd like you to approve. He read, hey, that's just what we need. He typed it on his stationery and took it down to council, and the mayor and the council and everybody. Hey, now we can fight this. It's been on the books for 40 years. It's in the state law. I just made it converted into a city ordinance. As far as I know, nobody to this day knows that the city ordinance on the books is exactly word for word, verbatim from the state law. BS rules the world, and that is a classic example of it. We didn't arrest anybody. You can't. Nobody knows what the hell pornographic literature is. But we keep trying.
Do you feel the department was stronger when you left it after the 6 years were up?
The department was stronger?
Yes.
I know it was stronger for a while. Now, the reason I know that, when I went in, I've always hollered a lot, I swear a lot, I'm very blunt, and I'm very abrasive. And a sensitive person wouldn't work with me 24 hours. He'd either kill me or die in the attempt. I laid down simple rules, said there aren't many of them, but I won't treat a crooked cop like a gentleman. I will not treat everybody alike. I'll treat a bastard like a bastard. Now, you want to play games? Fine. But I'll throw the first man into the penitentiary that I catch violating a law that will permit me to put him in the penitentiary. Now, as long as we understand each other, I don't care what you've done until now. When I am here, you're going to at least obey the law. Well, in those 6 years, I fired 7 men. I suspended 15 or 20, I forget which. I sent 2 to the penitentiary. And over that period of 6 years, they were never quite sure what I would do. I might point out, with no affectation at all, because I'm no more honest or honorable than you are or any other man. But when you arrest a policeman, you damn well better have clean hands when you go into that court. Because if you don't, they'll try you, not the crooked policeman. When I arrested these two policemen, I didn't want to arrest them. I didn't like to wash up dirty clothes, probably. I called them in the night before, and I talked to them for 4 hours, and I had tape recording the 4 hours. I had 3 or 4 captains, lieutenants, sergeants, detectives, and I begged them to sign a resignation and turn in their equipment, go home, and get out of town before the sun came up the next morning. Because if they were still in town the next morning, Beckenbaugh, the juvenile judge, was going to throw them in jail. They listened to everything, and I told them everything I had. They said, prove it. I said, okay, we'll do it the hard way. From the time that case started until it, from the time I filed the affidavits until the case started in Common Pleas Court, I was investigated. My hometown, every school I attended, every thing I had ever done. I used to drink, but I quit drinking. I'm drinking 2/5 of whiskey a day, and I quit. That was 1941, and I haven't had it since. They tried to find, I can't stop drinking 2/5 a day. If they get it for one drink of whiskey I had, one unlawful act I'd committed, one indecent thing, I wouldn't have convicted those people. I did convict them, son, about penitentiary. The department was stronger at the end of those 6 years because, not because they loved me, but because they were afraid. If this guy knows that I did this, this is going to happen. And it sure as hell would have happened. Now, in that sense, it was stronger. I don't think in any other way it was.
After the 6 years, you're out, and we get Mr. Golden in. What made you stay on?
Well, I wanted my 25 years in for retirement. And the chief reason I took the chief job in the first place was for the pension. Your pension was based on 25 years service minimum, and it's based on the 5 highest years salary. you could do. I made $8,300 a year, tops, as chief of police. As deputy traffic commissioner and later a sergeant, I made $5,200, $5,300. So I said I'd be better off retiring at half of $8,300 than half of $5,500. $360 a month pension. Patrolmen, not chief, but patrolmen now are retiring at $11,000, $12,000, $13,000 a year. I retired $4,000 a year as chief. But I served my 25 years. Then I went to Florida. I thought, well, I'll find a job down here somewhere. I had a very good friend down there, Dr. Goldkamp. And we were going down every other year sort of visit him. And I went to Cocoa Beach, Satellite Beach, and Cape Canaveral. Was offered a job chief of police in any one of the three cities. Along the east coast there, they have little cities, incorporated villages, 6 miles long and a half mile wide. It runs from the ocean into the Banana River. It's only about 3 or 4 blocks, which is 6 miles long. Chief got paid about $9,000 a year, but there was no work. Sun always shines, nobody violated the law. The police department was a two-stall garage, cement block, a little cell in the one corner. Nobody had a key for it, but a desk under a light was strung out of the ceiling. You could pull it on and off. But I couldn't take the heat. I can't take the heat to this day. So I came back here, and then Howard Jones called me and wanted me to come up to see him. I thought he wanted to start a police department. He said, no, I don't have any money for a police department. Don't need one. I said, doctor, I thought it was thundering, but it's not. It's the rocks rattling in your head. 18,000 students, you don't need a force. He said, no, I don't. And he didn't. They never locked doors or windows or closed buildings or a damn thing. And they didn't need a police department. He said, I need teachers. Well, in seminary, I taught New Testament Greek and philosophy. I wasn't crazy about teaching then, but he was starting a new department, criminal justice. He said, I'd like you to come up and teach. I said, what do you pay? He said, well, it took him 45 minutes to tell me he was going to pay me $5,200 a year. Well, that was my pension. Junior was going on the police department in Washington, and we have no kids, and I don't drink, we don't entertain much, I don't have any expenses. So I took it. My first class was at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the morning. My last class was at 8:30 at night. I taught 18 semester hours, not quarter hours. And when the state took over in 67, they said to the police force, you keep teaching, but organize, train, supervise a police force. So I started to hire a police force. When I left, I had about 20 full-time policemen and 40 or 50 part-time city policemen working at us. I kept my teaching down from 18 to 15 hours, and then I went on the quarter system. I cut it down to 11, and finally down to 8. And Dr. Kaufelt said one day, why don't you make up your mind? Either teach full-time or run the police department full-time. I said, what can you pay me to teach? He said, without a PhD, we can't pay you too much. I said, what can you pay me as a chief of police? He said, that we're free to pay whatever you want. So I quit teaching him. And I'm running a police department. But I left with tenure as assistant professor of criminal justice. Then when the Shipka organized a union in the faculty, they passed a rule of 65 compulsory retirement. I was 69 when that. The cop out said you can work one more year, but said even I have to quit, so I worked one more year and took me out. And I've been climbing the wall ever since.
What was it like with your background in law enforcement to be on a college campus in the late 60s and early 70s and with the uprisings and stuff?
My training didn't make much provision for what I was about to face at college. I've always felt a policeman is supposed to enforce the law. That's his primary job. If you tried to enforce the law on a college campus, you'd have half the college in jail. There's a difference. If these college kids weren't in college, half the things they do would get them 10 days in jail, 30 days in jail. But you learn to tolerate that and handle it through disciplinary action on the campus if it's serious enough. But you soon learn that it's the practice. Whether it's right or wrong, I've never been able to make up my mind. But I know it isn't practical to, quote, enforce the law, unquote. You just cannot. Now, in the 60s, late 60s and early 70s, when schools all over the country were having problems, the chief, which I think was Kent, we didn't have any problem. We had a few parades. We had a few demonstrations out on that amphitheater, and some of the professors, the more liberal ones, would get out and lecture to them, and they brought in some weirdos from Kent and Berkeley and Manhattan, Kansas, and around the country to try to pep them up and inspire them to kidnap the president or burn down a building. I talked to student council and fraternities and practically every organization on campus, and I said, you want to burn the place down? Burn it down. My job is a policeman. I'll throw you in the penitentiary. You do your thing, I'll do mine. But I'm not going to play patsy with you. The only damage we suffered was during the night of the spring weekend. They had a carnival out there, and some gal picked up a rock and threw it through one of the windows in Kilcally. It was about a $450 window. I could only find one guy that knew who she was or could identify her. He was the guy that manufactured the electricity for the lights. And he had left. He packed his generator up and was halfway to Akron. And I sent some of the city policemen out to catch him. They got him around like Milton, brought him back. And I said, can you identify this gal? He said, sure. He said, I even know her name. He gave me her name. I said, well, if we prosecute her, can you come back? He said, I don't know where I'll be when you prosecute her. I may be in Oregon. So it would punish him more than it would her. He'd get tenant costs and he'd be out half month's worth. So I said, the hell with it. Knew who she was. She was one of the radicals. When she graduated a couple years later, she went to work for the federal government in D.C. with a big time job. But that's the only problem we had. We kept two guys with a can of gasoline trying to burn down Pollock House because the ROTC was centered there. But they got scared. Instead of dropping the can, they carried the can with them back across the street. the cruiser coming up Wick Avenue and saw him running with a can, knew what it was. We didn't prosecute him, but I don't think we could have. I knew what they were doing, and they knew that I knew what they were doing, but to prove it, of course, something else. But that's... We had 400 or 500 out on the lawn of the president's old house, which is down next door to the art gallery. Pugsley was president. And they made demands, 16 demands. And they brought the demands down to the president's back door. 300 or 400 of them. And there was a, not retired, but an ex-Marine, I forget now his name. He had them in his hand. He said, "We want to go in and see the president." I said, "One of you can go in and see the president." Well, Black stood up and said, "We need a Black to go with." And I said, "Okay, then one Black and one White go in and see the president." They agreed which one. I opened the door, the back door, let them in and closed the door. Inside I had Bob Brown, a policeman up there, a big ex-Army sergeant, MP for 25 years, with a shotgun. I had three other policemen standing in there with shotguns. And I don't know what the Black thought, but I know that the policeman looked at this Marine when he came in, and he just stopped and looked at those, and he knew what a shotgun was. He walked over to the desk where the girl was, and he said to the president in. She said, "He'll be in a few minutes." He said, "Will you give him this when he comes in?" And they both turned and walked out. The next day, they gathered again on the front lawn. I had probably 50 or 60 policemen. My own and mostly downtown, a few state highway patrolmen called civilian clothes, sitting on the lawn. He came to the front door to answer their complaints, their 16 demands. And Buckley was a rough, tough old customer, but very, very fair and honest. One, two, he responded to this. He said, "This stupid asked question here, I won't bet if I'm answering." And he went on and answered the 16 complaints they had. They made a lot of noise, racket, and hollered. I had a microphone for them so that they could hear clear out to the street. But if you're going to make this much racket, I'm going to get out of here. No use me being here. So they'd quiet down and he'd talk with one or two of them. It was all peaceful. But across the street by the motel, I had the Youngstown Police Riot Squad. Helmets, tear gas, sick gas, loaded for riot. And they were pretty well trained in riot, too. And they were marking time behind the motel, just in case we needed them. We didn't need them. We never had any more trouble. And that wasn't any trouble. But some schools had an awful lot of it. Now I just will. When that started, students, I don't care whether they're students in a theological school or a railroad academy, if they kidnap a president, if they blow up a building, if they commit crimes of violence, felonies end on end, I'll treat them like the criminals they are, and if I have to shoot them, that's exactly what I'll do. Now, I've been a policeman too goddamn long to listen to a bunch of radicals tear down the best form of government in the world. Tear it down. Throw it in your face. I simply wouldn't tolerate it. My sympathy in the Kent affair is not with the students. My sympathy is with the National Guard that had to be subjected to the crap they went through. And my surprise is that didn't kill a hell of a lot more. Not that I wanted them killed or the poor killed. But if you stick your finger in a flame, you can expect it to be burnt. And if a student blows up a building where I'm a policeman, he can expect to be killed. I can hit him. If that's the only way I can catch him. Now, somewhere you have to draw a line. I think every university in the country followed that principle of tolerance because their students tolerate this, tolerate to a point you can do it. Kids break rules, they break serious rules sometimes. You can overlook it or treat it in a disciplinary fashion. But when they start to blow up buildings and kidnap presidents and do physical and material damage in the amounts of millions of dollars, people let them do it as bad as the students do the damage. But that's the only problem we had. You went through that in good shape.
Is there anything that we might not have gone over that you might think was important?
I can't help thinking that police service is at a highly precarious position right now. I've sent my sons on the police department in D.C. He graduated Ursuline here, and he spent the summer roaming around working for different contractors, and I said, now look, before you get drafted, or worse still, get married and then get drafted, get that service out of the way. He said, I beat you to it. He said, I joined the Marine Corps this afternoon. Now, he's the only child we have, and he's never been away from home. As a Boy Scout, he was away and get homesick overnight. But he joined the Marines. Well, I said, they'll either make you or break you. Why do you want the Marines? Sign up for 3 years. Served his time, and we went down to Parris Island to pick him up when he was mustered out. On the way home, he says, I'm not going back to Youngstown. He said, I'm going to settle him in Washington, D.C. He said, I don't think Youngstown has anything to offer. And he said, I've been told over the years to get into Washington after I got to like it. So I stopped in D.C. and went down to the FBI, and he picked up an application to the FBI. Came home, filled it out, took another physical exam, and sent it in. And he was accepted. Worked in the Record and Identification Bureau. Well, he's 6'2" and 120 or 220 pounds and rough. And that record room, if you ever saw it, row after row, floor after floor of records, they handle 85,000 a day all over the world. Record requests come in, and they come in a basket on a conveyor belt, and the basket will lower at this desk where he's working, and he may be working letters A through BI. That's all he's got, and he's got a whole wall, and he'll get the name out and go look through here, get the record and type it on the back of the letter and put it back in and send it up. He did that for a couple of years, and finally he got so fed up with it. He said, I started getting lazy, fat, so he quit. Went down, put an application into the police department. That's when I was taking him in to see Mike Kerwin to see if Mike could help him get out of the police department. So he had his application in for about a month. Never heard anything about it. When he put his application in just before the examination was given, and he took the exam, a month went by and he didn't hear anything. So I took him in to see Mike Kerwin. And Mike says, "You go home by tomorrow, they'll call you." Next morning, Chief Lee called and said, "I'll see you down here as soon as you can make it." And down, said, "When do you want to start to work?" He said, "This afternoon." He said, "Come out at 3 o'clock. Now, he's been working there for 19 years. A couple months ago, he called me and said, "I'm retiring." I said, "You're crazy, you can't retire, I don't have 25 years in." He said, "They're going to lay off between 700 and 900 men." But he said, "In order to reduce the effect of putting 700 to 900 men out of work, they're reducing the retirement from 25 years to 18. He said, "I have 19 years in." He said, "I can retire at 25 years service, 50% of my pay for my 19 years. In addition to that, you can buy a 3-year civil service from the FBI, 3 years civil service from the Marine Corps." He retired 2 months ago at 56% of his pay. So, but the last 6 or 8 years, he's been telling me, they've been hiring policemen, and they have trouble finding policemen in D.C. They've never been up to their full authorized strength, which is about 5,000, 600 or 700. But a couple of years ago, the chief of police sent word over to the U.S. Civil Service Commission, and he said, "Don't you ever send me another college police school graduate." He said, "Those guys are dynamite." He said, "They're no good for me. They'll never be policemen." Well, I thought it was only Youngstown was having that problem, because when I went up to school, I went down to see Mayor Flask, and I said, "Look, you could help the police department out a lot by encouraging these guys, and I'll come down and talk to them and encourage them to take some courses. If you let them take it on city time or pay their tuition or something for them." He said, "We'll let them take it on some time and we'll pay their tuition." So about 20 or 30 police went to this police science course we were instituting when I went in. And they graduated. But that course has changed a lot, and I suspect that other criminal justice courses in colleges and universities have changed also. They have become so academic that they have forsaken the practical aspects of police service. And that's not good. Policemen are notoriously good students. But policemen, by and large, are pretty damn good men. And give them something they can do and understand how to do, and they'll do a pretty good job. But you can't give them 4 years of academics and expect them to come out and do a rough and tumble job in the street. And that job in the street is rough and tumble. So, chief in D.C. had the same attitude that I had sensed downtown here, because the chiefs downtown have told me over the last years, "A lot of those guys you turn out up there aren't worth a damn." But most of them, at least down here, had police experience before they went up there, so they didn't let their education overshadow or influence their training. But in the meantime, they've got very few practical men teaching. PhDs. Now, the guy says a PhD is a guy that can describe a horse in 17 languages, but he buys a cow to ride to work. after a PhD with no police experience, trying to teach me how to become a policeman, I think is ridiculous. But that's the accent the university is putting on their criminal justice program. And I don't think it will work. And I think the criminal justice program they had for the first 10 years up there was the most popular outside of education. School of Education was the biggest. But the second biggest department they had, I think, for 8 or 10 years was criminal justice. Now I don't know how it's going down.
Would you recommend anybody to get into law enforcement?
I don't know. I think it would depend strictly on the type of individual. I would do it over again. I would do it with a hell of a lot of reservation. But I would do it over again, I think. But I think I would probably shoot at the federal level. There's lots of room in the police service on every level, especially the federal level. Difficulty there is you move around so much. The FBI men, they stay 2 or 3 years in one place, they move 5 miles away. Immigration, naturalization, the same way. Drug enforcement all over the world. Rough life, but if you like that, the guys that like it wouldn't trade it for anything. I like police work when I went at it. And I still like it. But I would think that a young man today should give serious thought to it. I think he should conduct his own personal investigation into the field that he wants. If he wants federal, let him spend some time with talking with federal officers in the field that he wants, whether it's drug enforcement, or, internal revenue, naturalization, FBI, what? Get some idea. Now, I've sent, I suppose, 20 to 30 young men and young girls to the FBI over the years. The FBI needs young men and women, high school graduates with good reputation, to work in their record and identification bureau. They need them so badly they even advertise for them. They pay them no great wage, but I suppose they pay them now $650 a month. They work 40 hours a week. All holidays off, Saturdays and Sundays off, or whatever days they want, but they work 40 hours. They can work nights and go to school days, or work days and go to school nights, however they want to do it if they want to go to school. And most of the kids I've sent down there have stayed. A lot of them get married. A lot of girls, a girl from Poland out here, she was down there 6 months, met a guy from Boardman. Didn't even know him, but they're both working a record. They get married. Now they've got over $1,000 a month income. They live in one room. Got a hot plate, pack their lunch, go to work, both go to school, had college degrees in 4 years. They had money in the bank, their parents didn't contribute a dime. 4 years civil service, they're on top of the world. Now, when the kids say they can't afford an education, that's a lot of malarkey, because if a kid today wants an education, there are too many places in Washington, D.C. alone where he can get it. They're going hungry for these kids just learn. So I would say there's a need for a good policeman, and if a man thinks he'll be a good policeman, he ought to try it.
Okay.